Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Reuben Stern. This summer's high temperatures and low rainfall has affected many throughout the Midwest. Here in Missouri, nearly 70% of the state is experiencing what is called extreme drought conditions, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. Farmers and livestock producers throughout the state are particularly affected. As just one example, the USDA has classified nearly half the corn crops in the state as being in very poor condition. So how are farmers and ranchers coping with this year's extreme situation? What might be the impact on food prices down the line? And could anything be done to mitigate the effects of drought in the future? Joining me in the studio to talk about the outlook for food production this year, Steve Wright is the vice president of the Missouri Farmers Union. He runs a 2,400-acre farm near Centralia, where he grows corn, soybeans, wheat, and hay. Welcome to our program, Steve Wright.
Hi. Thank you.
Glad to have you with us today. Also with us in studio, Patrick Ganan is an Extension Assistant Professor of Climatology at the University of Missouri. Welcome to the program, Patrick Ganan.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us as well. We also have in the studio Raymond Massey. He's an Extension Professor of Agriculture and Applied Economics at MU. Welcome to the program, Raymond Massey.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. We also have a guest by phone. Lonnie Duckworth is the President of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association. Welcome to our program, Lonnie Duckworth.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. We hope that those of you in our audience will also join the conversation today. How is the drought affecting you or the people you know? Give us a call. Share your story. Our phone number is 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And again, the time to call in is Monday afternoons between 2 and 3. I want to get started with this question. Patrick Ganan, just how bad are the conditions this year?
It's bad. Yeah, I mean, we'll put that into historical context. I've been saying it's a 1988-like, spring-like drought that has transitioned to a 1980 summer-like heat wave and drought. And so this May through July period, we've accumulated a deficit anywhere from 9 to 10 inches for the state as a whole. And it's not a good situation, considering May through July are typically our wettest months. And so just not good at all.
Right. And in terms of a 1988 or a 1980, I mean, how does the average person understand something like that?
Well, to put 1988 in perspective, and if you ask any farmer who's been farming for 25, 30 years, they will remember 1988. That was a horrible drought that impacted much of the Corn Belt. We saw fires in Yellowstone in Wyoming in 1988. This year we're seeing fires in Colorado. And 1980, again, for folks who've lived in Missouri for 30 years or so, they'll remember the summer of 1980. We had extreme heat, many days with triple-digit temperatures, 105, 110 degrees. And so we've gone from the dryness that we've seen this spring to the heat and dryness into the July of 1980. And so it's a one-two punch that's really showing a lot of impacts, not only in agriculture, but it's starting to transition into other sectors as well.
Right. Steve Wright, do you remember those years?
Oh, yeah. It seems like you remember them. The bad ones better than the good ones, unfortunately. All I can tell you is now we have newer technologies, say, for instance, the corn hybrids and this and that, and they're failing this year. Our hopes were that possibly they'd do better than prior years, but the heat, the high heat in itself has been one problem, and it started so early the drought did.
Right. Well, let's talk about that for a second. When you say it's failing, I mean, for those of us who are not farmers, what does that mean that a crop is failing?
Well, it's not something that happens over, you know, one day. We sit there and watch it day after day after day. And we planted, for instance, our crop was planted over, say, a 10-day, 2-week period. So different day length hybrids. So they don't all fail at the same time. That's how we try to handle nature. Well, each one has failed just like a stack of dominoes from just the heat in itself. And like we do no-till and various things like that I'd like to think would help us raise at least something. And in some cases, nothing that we have done has helped because of the severity of it.
And what that was a corn crop?
Mm-hmm.
And so at what point does a crop like corn pass the point of no return? Like, at what point is it no longer a viable crop as a plant?
Well, I'd say a majority of the corn right now in the state is probably beyond help from any rain. The irrigation people are still trying to add bushels to their crop, and the rain would still help anything that's green. But once you see that you drive by the road and it's a pale color to a yellow where it's maturing, it's done too late. In some cases, maybe before that, when it went to form the ear and came up with nothing.
And so you're saying most of the corn crop in the state, is even if we got rain, it wouldn't help?
The majority of it has already been damaged. There's some areas where they've had some rain, what I call microclimates, I guess is the correct description. There are some places where they'll have corn in bottoms and things like it's protected from the high wind. But overall, the corn crop is done. Now we're worried about the bean crop.
Right. And what's the implication for farmers at this point then? If the corn crop is done, the bean crop is uncertain, that we're not quite sure what's going to happen with the weather, what's going to happen with farmers?
Well, a lot of the farmers in the state of Missouri purchase crop insurance. And those who have purchased crop insurance, particularly revenue protection, have a pretty good level of protection and will come through this without a whole lot of financial negatives. The ones that are going to be hit financially negative for sure are the livestock producers, because corn and soybean prices are going up. That means feed prices are going up. Forages are not being grown. I mean, the ground out there is dry, hay's down, pasture's down. So the livestock producers really are going to be hit pretty hard financially as a result of this.
Right. And what are you hearing from the farmers at this point?
Most of the conversation I have is with crop farmers, and they're just asking the question of, all right, I'm going to have a very low corn yield. What are my options, and how does that affect my insurance? And so for most corn farmers, they can call their insurance agent up, have him come out to look at the farm. They will come up with either an adjusted yield that they'll pay insurance on or leave a strip that needs to be harvested as normal. And then they can harvest it as a silage, which will be used to feed cattle or dairy animals.
Right. Okay, I want to remind our audience quickly, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the drought in Missouri and across the Midwest. Joining me in the studio are Steve Wright, Vice President of the Missouri Farmers Union, Patrick Ganan, Extension Assistant Professor of Climatology at the University of Missouri, Raymond Massey, Extension Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at MU, and on the phone we have Lonnie Duckworth, the President of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association. For those of you in our audience, what concerns do you have about this summer's drought? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. And we'd like to remind you that Intersection takes place live every Monday at 2 on KBIA and online at kbia.org. You can be part of the conversation at that time, and you can also watch our video stream by going to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. So in terms of we were talking about crop insurance. Mm-hmm. In terms of that crop insurance, what exactly gets covered and what doesn't get covered for a typical farmer?
Well, it depends on what kind of crop insurance you purchase. There are what I call three major types of crop insurance. Revenue protection, which is the most prevalent, covers your revenue. So you insure a certain percentage of your expected revenue. But you also have yield protection, which covers your yield and pays at a lower indemnity price if you do have a claim. And then there's what they call group risk premium or group risk programs, which actually covers the yield of your county, not of your particular field. And so, like I said, most producers, in fact, about 65% of the producers in the state purchase a revenue protection in which they guarantee themselves anywhere from 55 to 85% of their expected revenue, and they get to choose again which percent of revenue they're going to cover.
Right. And is the expected revenue based on what they expect to get every year, or is it based on what the projections are for the year ahead, or how is that?
Okay. The revenue is your yield times the price. So the yield is what is your average for the last 10 years. And then they multiply it times a price that was established on March 1st, essentially, and it is the February average price of the December corn futures. So it's kind of a complicated way of going about it. But on March 1st, they determined that the price for corn for insurance purposes was $5.67. So you'd multiply your, $5.68.
And that's per bushel, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, per bushel. So if you had 150 bushels and you were expecting $5.68, which people were on March 1st, that would give you about an $815 expected revenue. And then you would say, okay, I choose to insure 75% of that, and that would give you a $639 revenue that you guaranteed.
Right.
So, they choose that revenue. Now, the interesting thing about revenue protection insurance is that if the price goes up, as it has here in the last month, it's gone up $2, then your protection actually goes up. So they protect you based on the highest of either the March price or the market price in October.
So in this case, if farmers could salvage part of their crops, they might actually do pretty well.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I've had farmers call me up and say, hey, I've only got 10 bushels to the acre. I don't even want to harvest it. And I look at them and I say, 10 bushels to the acre times $7 a bushel is $70, and it's only going to cost you $30 to harvest it. So it sounds like you don't want to put the combine through it, but you still want to harvest even a 10-bushel yield.
Interesting. We have another sort of expert on the phone I want to bring into the conversation. Bruce Babcock is the Cargill Chair of Energy Economics at Iowa State University. Bruce, are you with us? Okay, we had Bruce Babcock on the phone. Are you still there, Bruce? Okay, we'll bring him in a minute. We'll get that technical thing sorted out. It raises a question in terms of what you just said, that the farmers might not be inclined to want to harvest their crops if there's only, you know, a limited potential for all of that work. What's to keep the farmers actually doing that if they're insured against the loss?
Well, first off, the insurance contract requires that you use what's called best management practices. So if you can harvest it, you need to harvest it. If you're going to claim a loss, you need to call the insurance adjuster out there. And the sad part is, if he says there's 2 bushels out there, 2 bushels times $7 is only worth 14, and it's going to cost you $30 to harvest, he still tells you, go out there and harvest it. And if you don't, I'm not going to pay you for that 2 bushels. So the objective is farmers will use best management practices. If they don't, it will affect their insurability or their insurance contract. So for the most part, there still is incentive to maintain and try and get a crop out of the field.
Right. So, I mean, what it sounds like I'm hearing is that even though these conditions are pretty bad, a lot of farmers are not going to be in particularly bad shape this year. Is that right?
If they purchased revenue protection, they're not going to be in very bad shape. And about 65% of Missouri farmers or Missouri acres are covered by revenue protection. And that will probably, because the price has gone up, give them revenue equal to what they expected in March. Mm-hmm. But the 65% purchase revenue protection, that means that there's another 35% that are either uninsured or insured with a less complete insurance. Those guys are probably going to be experiencing a level of hurt that they recognize and the banker recognizes.
Right. Okay, I think we have Bruce on the line. Bruce, are you there now?
I am.
Okay, Bruce Babcock from Iowa State University, thanks for joining us. We were just talking about crop insurance and the outlook for farmers who have it not being so bad. What's the outlook for the insurance companies themselves that are going to have to be paying out all of these claims?
Well, in fact, they're not the ones who will be paying most of the claims. It'll be their reinsurers. They buy a tremendous amount of reinsurance, and they get reinsurance from the federal government. So those two sources are the ones who are going to be making the payments. So I don't think the crop insurance companies themselves are going to be experiencing too much financial difficulty.
Right. And so do you have a sense of how big the impact is going to be, either, you know, just in this region or across the country, in terms of what the government might have to pay out?
Well, I know that the bigger the impact, the greater the share the government will pay out. I just don't know, and I haven't seen any credible estimates of what the corn yields are going to be by state or soybean yield losses.
Okay. Steve, I want to ask you about this. I mean, how many of the farmers that you talk to are in the situation that Raymond described in terms of having the insurance and being, you know, fairly covered for some of this, as opposed to that other percentage that are not?
I would guess that mainly your younger farmers, middle-aged farmers, would be very covered. If I had to guess, it would be your older, close to retirement, or retired farmers that choose not to participate in those programs. Now, as far as these crops and stuff not harvesting right now, one thing you want to bear in mind, if we don't deal with this crop and try to go and harvest it, then it becomes a problem for us next year. So,
and what's the problem? What happens?
Well, we'll have volunteer corn out in the beans, and you'll have, say, cover or hard times planting to plant into that if you don't deal with it this year. But one thing I'd like to point out here, some of the reason why farmers may not want to traditionally harvest is they're looking at, say, foliage, trying to get it for their cow herds and this and that. And I expect Larry can address this issue. It's extremely important to harvest it before it completely burns up. And that's the dilemma some of them are facing now. Now, we have issues with the herbicide carryovers or in case the insecticides that it's very important now to understand the labels so that from the crop safety standpoint for our livestock. And that gets to be a complicated issue in itself.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. What exactly is going on with a lot of these crops that would make it difficult to feed? I mean, is there widespread use of insecticides on these crops?
Well, that probably isn't the issue so much right now as is nitrogen, which is one of our fertilizers. And I don't, Larry probably can address this more about the dangers of that right now.
Lonnie, how about that? You know, what are you looking at? Because you're, you know, as part of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association, I mean, you guys are in a pretty big bind here, right, in terms of feed and water and all those things?
Yes, we have. It's kind of all over the board. We have people that are in a bind right now, and those that know they're going to be in a bind. Our feed supply was cut short this spring, I think I said generally, and there were some spots that seemed to be pretty good, but a lot of spots that had less hay than normal. Fortunately, we had a mild winter last winter, but we started feeding a little earlier because of the lack of forage, because of dryness last fall and winter. So we didn't have that carryover stockpile fescue like we normally have here in the state of Missouri. So we're already short of hay, and now we're feeding, including myself. I'm feeding, although I'm just supplementing at this point. There are others that have been feeding full-time for even a month before. That, you know, we're going to use up all of our feed supplies and our reserves. We always take pride in having reserves, but we just don't have the reserves this year. This silage will help alleviate it, the feed situation somewhat. But those that have water issues, you know, you can usually find feed or something for the cows to eat, but when you're out of water, you're done.
Right.
And we do have that situation. And it also, you know, you take low ponds going into the winter, it's conceivable that they could even freeze dry.
Huh. Okay, let me just remind everyone once more. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the drought in Missouri and across the Midwest and the implications for agriculture related to that. Joining me in the studio are Steve Wright, Vice President of the Missouri Farmers Union, Patrick Ganan, Extension Assistant Professor of Climatology at the University of Missouri, Raymond Massey, Extension Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at MU, and on the phone, you just heard from Lonnie Duckworth, President of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association. For those of you in our audience, how is the drought affecting you or the people you know? Give us a call. Share your story. Our number, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. We talked about insurance for people growing crops. Bruce Babcock, you're still with us?
I sure am.
What's the situation in terms of insuring people who are raising cattle or livestock of some kind?
The most available form of insurance for them is called livestock gross margin insurance. It covers increases in feed costs, or reductions in the price for their livestock. The problem is that Congress has a $20 million a year cap on the cost of that program, so it sells out in about 2 months. So it was far sold out before farmers could buy enough insurance to insure against the effects of this drought.
Right. Lonnie, do you have a sense of how prevalent that kind of insurance is among cattle farmers in Missouri?
Not very prevalent. As a matter of fact, I can't tell you one person that's got that I know of.
Right. And so, I mean, is that just culturally among cattle farmers not something that they invest in, or is it just a recent – why is that? That's, I guess, is my question. Why is it that, you know, crop farmers seem to be fairly well insured and cattle farmers not?
Well, we just don't have the available programs to us that through the government that the crop farmers has always had. And so, you know, it just hasn't been part of our operation. You know, most crop farmers, they either take out the insurance, or if they're dealing with lenders, you know, the lenders will probably require them to take out a certain amount of insurance to mitigate the risk of that loan. But we have not had that, have not really had that opportunity. So it's been a non-issue for cattle people.
Right. Go ahead, please.
I might just mention that crop farmers beginning to use crop insurance has got a long history. Back in the early 1990s, not very many farmers had crop insurance, or at least what we call multi-peril crop insurance. They may have had what's called hail or fire, but not multi-peril. And the federal government wanted them to begin taking out multi-peril crop insurance, so they subsidized it quite heavily. And then it became essential for participation in some farm programs. So there were a lot of incentives that got farmers to using crop insurance in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And then the subsidies that have been paid by the federal government have made it where over the last 10 years, for Missouri corn farmers, they've received about $2 for every dollar that they've paid in indemnities. In premiums. So it actually has been somewhat of an income source, not for every individual farmer, but for all the farmers in Missouri who grow corn. So, in some ways, it's a very smart decision to purchase corn insurance because it's of its subsidization from the government. And it helps with getting other farm programs. It's required that you be insured in order to get other farm programs.
Right. In terms of that, I mean, part of that is to help stabilize the farmers and keep them in business, right? That's the goal of that. Mm-hmm. What about the flip side of that, that in terms of the implications of, you know, having a smaller amount of corn out there? I mean, that's going to ricochet. I mean, people are worried about food prices. The FDA came out the Department of Agriculture released numbers last week saying that food prices are probably going to go up in the coming year. I mean, how is that going to play out? How worried should people be that, you know, these corn crops not coming through are actually going to ripple through the food system?
Well, that's where crop insurance comes in. For instance, the input costs went up probably two and a half times what they were not many years ago. Beans, you have income coming in. Next year, you can plant another crop. If we didn't have that and you had to start with zero, I don't know if there would be very many people could make it back to the field. So, I mean, they're actually projections that we will plant more corn this next year. That's what the big companies think, and they're trying to meet demand with seed corn as we speak now. So, I mean, there will be an effect to help the public the next year from these programs that are in place this year.
Right, in order to keep the farmers going after a year like this.
Yeah. But crop insurance at this point really is to help the farmers, not necessarily to help the consumers. So, you know, if you have essentially a nationwide drought like we currently are having, yields of crops will go down, and crop insurance might help with the income of farmers, but it's not going to help the yields go up. It's meeting financial needs, not production needs.
Right. Let's talk about a little bit, some of what is trying to be done in addition to the crop insurance. I mean, the governor last week increased the amount of money the state was going to put toward helping farmers get water to their crops, right? So more assistance for wells and irrigation type things like that. How likely is that to help the situation?
Well, I think that obviously there's probably not enough. He doesn't have enough access to enough money to really make a great impact. I applaud what the governor, or the cattlemen employed, what the governor is trying to do. It's going to take an awful lot of money. You're probably talking somewhere in the neighborhood of $10,000 on average to put a well into operation, to drill it and put it in operation. And, when you talk $10,000 a pop, it doesn't take too long until it turns into real money.
Right.
And, he is willing, the governor is willing to do what he can do with what he has, and it's going to save some folks. But it can't save everybody.
And how effective is that? I mean, the idea of digging wells either deeper or making them, bigger. Is there enough water down there for the cattle farmers, for example, to be able to keep their herds the size that they are?
Well, I don't know that we know that for sure, but in places the water table has dropped, and that's obviously, it's obvious by some of the springs that have gone dry recently that haven't been dry in the past. And some of that water table will be replenished in the future. But if we can get over this this crisis right now, and I would also like to see the governor, possibly put some money toward digging ponds and that type of thing, so that we will be ready when the rains do come back, and they will.
Would you agree with that, Patrick Ganan? The rains are going to come back?
Oh, sure, yeah. That'll be bad.
Just thought we'd ask the weather expert. We were talking a little bit before the program about the sort of spans and historical perspective on this. I mean, right now we're in a pretty bad year. How likely is it that it might be a persistent thing for a few years as opposed to just a blip?
Well, it's really hard to forecast exactly what's going to happen with this drought. I will say that I think things will only get worse before they get better. We're still at the end of July, and August is typically our driest summer month. And when weather patterns set up in the summertime, they tend to be somewhat stable. They're stagnant. They stick around. And that's what we've seen this summer. There will be opportunities as we go into August and September. September is a transition season. The jet stream begins to migrate back southward. More systems could provide better chances of widespread, significant precipitation events. September is typically a wetter month on average. And so that's what we need. We need an abrupt pattern change that'll be wetter and break significant rainfall. There's also an opportunity for tropical systems. Hurricane season is coming up in August and September, and we will see more precipitation, hopefully, in September, and perhaps the tropical system can be a drought buster. So.
Okay. Well, is it possible that we might see hurricane season a little sooner since we've been 30 days ahead of our normal seasons all along?
Well, I think using climatology, tropical systems are more frequent in August and they peak out in the middle part of September. So I remember in 2003, we had an extreme drought impacting, a localized drought impacting northwest and west central Missouri, and we did have the remnants of a tropical system that brought 3 to 6 inches of rain and really brought a lot of help to that area.
Okay. Just got to let everyone know this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the drought in Missouri and across the Midwest, and we'll be right back after a short break. Please stick around. Welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the drought in Missouri and across the Midwest. Joining me in the studio are Steve Wright, Vice President of the Missouri Farmers Union, Patrick Ganan, Extension Assistant Professor of Climatology at the University of Missouri, Raymond Massey, Extension Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at MU, and on the phone we have Lonnie Duckworth, President of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association. For those of you in our audience, if you're a farmer, we would love to hear from you. How are you responding to the drought conditions this year? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. During the break, we were talking a little bit more about the weather and what might happen if it rains a whole bunch for the rest of the year. Does that make this an average year?
No, not at all. Not at all. It would be nice to obviously see a wet weather pattern. And, you know, the fall season is typically a good time of year to establish recharge and bring those water resources above and below the ground back to capacity. Obviously, we're running well below normal. We've accumulated a 9 to 10 inch deficit, and so it will take some significant rain events, hopefully, you know, as soon as possible. But I think most likely it'll be this fall that we see some relief.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. What would happen if in the month of August we got 9 inches of rain and caught up?
Well, it all depends on how it falls. Does it fall over a two-hour period, or does it fall over various times? And that's highly unlikely that we will see that sort of scenario. August is generally a dry month. It's our second hottest month. And we'll just have to wait and see. I think our best opportunities will come in September and October.
Okay, so even in September, October, let's say we got, you know, interspersed over a two-month period, we wound up getting 10 to 11 inches of rain to catch it back up, make it an average year. Is the ground ready for that? I mean, would it?
Well, sure. I remember in 2003 when we had that extreme drought impacting northwest and west central Missouri, we had cracks in the ground that were 6 to 8 inches wide. And so when that rain fell, it literally was soaked up and helped bring back livestock ponds back up and things like that. In September and October, we start winding toward dormancy with vegetation, shorter periods of daylight, and so evaporation rates are not so high. So that's also when that rain falls, it'll have better opportunities to percolate through the soil profile and bring those water levels back up.
Steve, would you be able to do anything with that rain at that point if it were September when it started raining again?
I'll take it when I can get it. I will say this. One of the things that a huge factor of this drought is the heat. Now, here in Missouri with our forages, particularly with fescue, it's shut down anyway just from that fact alone. Even if we get rain today, it'll be a while before the temperature gets low enough where it can start growing again. So it's not going to end just because we have a rain tomorrow. It'll help, but there's still long-lasting effects of this.
Mm-hmm. Lonnie, your thoughts on that?
Well, yes, we're going ahead and get some rains now, you know, and this temperature would moderate. We could still have some fall picking for the cows. Now, we're not going to have any stockpiling, but at least we could have something that would alleviate, this feed need right now.
Right. Okay, we have a caller on the line. Debbie from Jefferson City is on the line. Debbie, are you with us?
I am, yes.
Great. Thanks for joining the program today and for calling in.
Well, thank you. It's been very interesting listening. My family has had 300 acres in Ralls County, Missouri, for a number of years. And unfortunately, as I understand it, Ralls County is number one in lack of rainfall this year. I think we're like 15 plus inches behind. Last year we had 200 bushels per acre of corn, and this year we'll be lucky to get 2 bushels per acre. And I wanted to mention that only because I just don't know that I really believe something like that could ever happen. Fortunately, our family doesn't depend on that income. As I mentioned, it's inherited property, so we've gone on to other kinds of work. But there are so many who will be financially impacted in a very devastating way. I have a question, though, about ethanol and how commitments that farmers make to ethanol companies in advance of the harvest impact, you know, which is better, to make ethanol or to feed the cattle? I'm curious to know how ethanol production, as great as it is, as a market as it has been for us, how is that impacting particularly feed for animals at this point? And which of the two is more important, that we have ethanol or that we be able to feed the animals. So I'll hang up and listen to your expert.
All right. Thanks for your question. Let's start with Steve on that, and then we'll go to Lonnie because I'm sure he's got some thoughts too.
Okay. Well, one of the things up home, there are actually livestock producers' own shares and ethanol plants. Traditionally, they raise row crops and have cows both. Also, there's some actually engage in direct feeding livestock out that own shares and ethanol. So it's not an issue of just row crop farmers, but it also is pretty much farmers in the whole community. Now, the question you pose, these people own shares in their own ethanol plants, so they're required to supply a certain amount of corn to that plant. And the ethanol doesn't take all the corn and use every bit of it that goes in the factory the plant. It also generates DDGs, which goes back out to the livestock industry. So there's a return. It's not, you don't use the whole bushel.
When you say DDGs, what does that mean?
Well, it's a refined processed feed product. It's really high in protein, and I'm not able to tell you exactly all the benefits from it. But anyway, it does go back to the livestock industry. The thing you got to remember here is we as a nation produced enough corn was planted that it should have met all the requirements. So you go into this issue now, I think the laws of economics will dictate who gets the corn if we're a true free enterprise system. So, I mean, they've released the CRP. They're doing some other things which helps the livestock industry. So, you know, we tried to handle this thing before it happened. And now here we are in a major drought that nobody could foresee.
Right. Lonnie, your thoughts on that question posed by our listener, Debbie.
Well, you know, I think, as I recall right now, I think ethanol uses about 40% of the corn crop, of the corn produced, typically. Livestock is by far the largest consumer of grains. I don't know how it's going to impact the ethanol. I think it's probably going to be maybe some plants may even have to consider shutting down for a while because it's going to be so high that I don't know that they can make that, you know, it is economically feasible to run the plant. But, you know, it just makes feed prices higher, you know, to livestock and also to our foodstuff. Mm-hmm. And even the byproduct has been cheaper than what corn has, is the DDG. For instance, you know, there's going to be fewer of them and probably it's going to be in a higher price. And demand's going to be pretty good, too, try to keep these cows or this livestock going.
Right. Raymond, do you have thoughts on this ethanol versus feeding cows question?
Well, it's really quite complicated because of the policy that the federal government has instituted. Right now, the renewable fuel standard demands about 9.5% or 10% of all of our gasoline be ethanol. So that's why we have gasohol. When the corn prices get as high as they are, even the ethanol plants who have a mandate, or really the gasoline blenders have a mandate to blend ethanol, they don't want to pay as much as it costs because of the high value of corn or the high cost of corn. So they'll probably close down, and at that point, that'll reduce some of the demand for corn, help alleviate the price a little bit. Yet at the same time, they've got to meet this renewable fuel standard. So how can they close down? They do have what we call RINs, I think, renewable identification numbers, that they have to trade. And once those get high enough, the ethanol company would say, well, I have to pay too much for my corn, but I'm getting a value out of my renewable identification numbers, and therefore I can pay that high price for corn. So it's really a complicated system. If there were not the renewable fuel standards, it would be, as Steve talks about, just the market. Which one's more valuable, ethanol or meat? But with the renewable fuel standard, it's not quite a free market at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we haven't even talked about the export question, right? Because a large share of the U.S. corn crop gets exported to other countries, right?
Historically, it has, yes.
Yeah, you say historically. Is that implying that something's going to change this year?
Well, if we are short here in the United States and other countries don't want to pay as high as the price is becoming, then they'll purchase less of it, and therefore we'll have less exports.
Now, one thing, it wasn't very long ago, about 2-3 months ago, the fact that we were in the field planting crops real early, there were people projecting we'd see corn prices go down drastically, below $4 even, I was hearing something. So it wasn't that long ago it was going to be in the livestock industry's favor that they were going to have a lot cheaper feed. And here this changed because of Mother Nature later. Plans were in place to have plenty of corn. I guess really the only way we can handle something like this is they're talking about coming up with a reserve program where you try to hold back some of it during a real cheap time for when it is a lot higher.
Right. Lonnie, is that a bit of a double whammy for cattle farmers? They expected corn to be cheap, and now it's not just back at regular prices, but in fact quite high because of the situation?
I don't know that it's a double whammy. I don't know how much how many anticipated that corn was going to be cheap. There was some talk of that earlier, you know, when there's planting so much corn. But I haven't heard that talk for quite some time now. you're right in terms of the price right now on exports. They should be probably down because primarily our customers are going to say, you know, price is too high. We can't hardly do it. And then I think we also ought to be concerned, too, about trying to be able to supply our own first. Just makes sense to me. So by the export market being down because of high prices, it will make more available to the local people and the livestock people.
Okay. Again, I want to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the drought in Missouri and across the Midwest and the implications of that. Joining me in the studio are Steve Wright, Vice President of the Missouri Farmers Union, Patrick Ganan, Extension Assistant Professor of Climatology at the University of Missouri, Raymond Massey, Extension Professor of Agricultural and Applied Economics at MU. And on the phone, we have Lonnie Duckworth, President of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association. For those of you in our audience, if you are affected by the drought in some way, we'd love to hear how that's going for you and how you're responding. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org. One of the questions I wanted to ask about, you know, we've read in some western states that a lot of cattle farmers are thinning their herds at this point, that they're selling off a lot of the stock because it's getting to be difficult to keep all those cows in a drought situation. Lonnie, are you hearing that happening in Missouri yet?
There's 5 cases of that happening. And as each day goes by and as that water supply gets less and as the feed supply gets less, you're hearing more and more talk about it. I know that there's been a number of calves, for instance, spring calves, that really aren't ready for market now, but they've been pulled off green and sent to town just to try to alleviate the demand for feed and water. I just returned from a National Cattlemen's Beef Association conference, summer conference in Denver this week, and the primary topic there, you know, out in the hallways anyway, was weather. You know, it's we're not the only ones in this shape. It's all over the Midwest, and that's what's really putting a hurt on things, both feed and water issues. So we may think we're alone, and sometimes you feel like it, but we're not.
And does that help or hurt to know that there are other farmers in the same situation?
Well, I don't know that it does either. It's sad that we're all in this situation. I guess it does help a little bit to know that you got some company and you're not just standing out there alone taking it all. But I think for those areas of the country that got plenty of hay and so forth, they're going to be shipping hay into us probably, you know, kind of like we did to Texas and Oklahoma and New Mexico last year. I guess one thing that I kind of hate to see in that case is where some of the prices get so high and some people get a little greedy, you know, that have the hay to sell. If that happened last year, it may be coming back to get even this year.
Right.
Ruben, you asked a question about does it help or hurt to know that there are so many other people in that same situation. Interestingly, when there's a lot of people in that situation for crops, like we have this widespread drought, the price of crops goes up. But if you ask Lonnie what's happened with the price of the feeder cattle that are being sold right now, they're going down. And so when there's a lot of folks that are needing hay, pasture, and don't have it, when they liquidate their herds early, they're actually selling it at a lower price, and so they're double hurt. Now, hopefully a year or so from now, the prices will be back up. But again, I just reiterate that for livestock producers, this is a double hurt situation.
Right. And where do they go? Well, I mean, if they're selling the cows, you know, at a lower price now, who's buying them? Are they being turned into meat right now, or are they being shipped off to areas of the country that have water?
There have been there have been quite a number of breeding quality cows, breeding cows and of higher quality that have been turned into hamburger. But there are areas. I think an order buyer I know just sent some cows down towards Central Texas. So there are spots in the country that that still can afford to buy cows and have the feed and water to do so. Mm-hmm.
Patrick, do you know of areas that are not affected as much in the country?
Well, that's really what sticks out as a climatologist, the magnitude of this situation. We have drought, severe drought that extends from California to Ohio. The core of it is pretty much from Colorado through Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. And we've heard discussion on how it's being compared to the 1950s. Well, that's the parallel. This is spatial coverage that we haven't seen since 1956. And so there's a lot of folks that are being impacted by this. In regard to perhaps who might be doing okay is maybe parts of the Dakotas, North Dakota, South Dakota, a little bit of Wisconsin, though southern Wisconsin got hit pretty hard this month as well, a little bit of Minnesota. The Corn Belt, all that area is really being hit hard. And what's adding insult to injury is last year we had the Southern Plains drought, Texas and Oklahoma, and crops and livestock were hit exceptionally hard. So back-to-back years we're seeing this in some parts of the country. Only this year, two-thirds of the country is experiencing some form of drought, and that's something we haven't seen in more than 50 years.
Let me ask this. Go ahead, please.
If I may comment, again, on this price thing, you know, a comment was made earlier, you know, that our prices are going down in contrast to grain prices going up. And that is right. I think we're off probably $50, $60 a hundred from where we were 4 months ago. And that's a significant cut in pay. I had another thought, and I guess I missed it. So anyway, our cow numbers in Missouri or in the nation are right now at about the same numbers they were in 1953. They're very low. And now we have this drought situation that's causing breeding stock to be sent to slaughter because there's no place else for them to go, is really exacerbating that situation. So, you know, yes, our prices will rebound one of these days, but they may rebound very, very high.
Yeah, I mean, the prediction is that the beef prices are actually going to be 4 to 5% higher next year.
Well, that sounds kind of low. 4 to 5%. You know, especially when we get when there is green grass again, and we get into an expansion phase here, where breeding heifers or heifers for breeding will be kept back, it'll even take that many more pounds off the market, and so that's going to also impact price.
Interesting, Lonnie. Have you heard of any livestock farmers saying, you know, that's it, I'm done here, I'm going to sell it all off?
Yes.
And how prevalent is that?
I can't say that I've heard a very high percentage of that yet, but I've heard of those that are saying, I may have to do that.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's scary. It's scary to them, and it's scary to the rest of us in the industry, too.
Right. Steve, what about with crop farmers? Are you hearing anybody say, you know, this is getting too complicated here?
Well, I think some of the older farmers are pretty disgusted with the overall cost of inputs, how high it is, and then this drought. I'm not hearing that as much as when I talk to the livestock people I talk to now are ones dealing with this directly right now. Those of us in the row crop industry are, you know, it'll be this fall when we really get a handle on how bad it is. But the livestock sector, I mean, we have cows too. And I mean, this is something that's going to be long term. It'll take several years. It's not like we plant a crop next year and try again.
You're right.
This is going to take 2 or 3 years for a family to recover from something, I guess, minimum.
Mm-hmm. And are farmers optimistic, or are they, I mean, what kind of mood would you say is prevalent out there?
Lonnie, you probably...
You'd be farming if you weren't optimistic, right?
Yeah, I think that he's hit the nail on the head there. I mean, you hope for the best and plan for the worst when you try to develop a plan to handle what nature throws at you. We have no control of the rainfall. And it varies from, you know, you can go 5 miles down the road and see a change in how much rainfall people have gotten, even right now as we speak.
Right. Well, let me ask this. I want to follow up on something that Patrick said, you know, in terms of we had a drought in the southern part of the Midwest last year. There's drought across a wider portion of the U.S. this year. Are we headed for another Dust Bowl here?
I wouldn't go as long as far as this. The stage is set. We do have a lot of drought impacting a portion of the country, most of the country, and it's going to take a significant pattern change where the jet stream is going to bring a lot of systems across the country to bring widespread and significant precipitation events. To say that we're heading towards a period of extreme dryness, I think that's a little premature. I mean, just a few years ago, we were talking about unprecedented wetness. 2008 was our wettest year on record. 2009 ranked in the top 10 wettest years on record. 2010 was a wet year. So this is a fairly short-lived situation. Unfortunately, we see a lot of impacts, but to say that it's going to last a multi-year event, I wouldn't go that far.
What about the swinging between extremes? I mean, if it was that recently that we were at the opposite end of the spectrum and now we're all the way at a widespread drought, I mean, is that something that might get more common, that swinging?
You can go look through historical records and you can find them pretty much back in the late 1800s and through about every decade. 1980 is a good example. We had a very hot and dry year in 1980. 1981 for the summertime. Then the summer of 1981 was one of the wettest summers on record. So 1935 was also a fairly decent precipitation and temperature pattern across Missouri, whereas 34 and 36 were extreme drought and heat. So you can get these abrupt pattern changes throughout the climate record.
Right. Well, are there things being done differently on farms now than there were in the 30s that might, even if the weather were to replicate what happened back then, that would...
That's a good point. In the 1930s, that was a decade-long drought. And it was what happened during the 1930s. We had the what they call black blizzards. All this dust and topsoil was picked up in the central plains and moved eastward. And that was because of till practices. And that's how the Soil Conservation Service started, was a reaction to what was happening during the 1930s and poor conservation practices.
Mm-hmm. Steve, you nodded on that one.
Well, for instance, we no-till a lot. I mean, we've got cover, and the crops, for the most part, have grown fairly well to protect the soil. If this goes on for another year or two, it'll get serious. But for now, things are in place that are helping.
And what could be done differently by farmers if it did continue for another year or two? Are there other changes that could be done that would help conserve the soil or help sort of counteract the effects of a prolonged drought?
Probably the most important thing right now is a farm bill. We don't have a farm bill yet, and I think Lonnie may give a point on this from the last talk, but without a game plan, we don't know exactly what we got to work with. And NRCS, they have foliage-type systems they can put in place, various tools they could help with livestock and row crop both, but without passage of the farm bill, they're just stagnant.
Mm-hmm. Lonnie, do you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I think you said pretty well what the way it is. I don't really have anything to add.
What about our economist here? Raymond, do you want to weigh in on that?
You know, I haven't kept track of the current farm bill debates to know how they would impact this. I know the farm bill historically has put a lot of emphasis on environmental improvement, but that is beginning to wane a little bit, so I'm not sure what the new farm bill has for that. But I know that they've talked about fewer acres in CRP, Conservation Reserve Program, which would be to help protect the soil and water quality.
Let me ask you, Steve, what would you like to see in the farm bill in order for it to help farmers like you out?
Well, it'd be nice they quit playing politics with it and actually listen to the farmers. You know, everybody, because it's you know, each county, each state, everybody's different. There's not a one-shoe-fits-all, and I think they need to address all the industries, you know, in a fair fashion. We really make an effort to do that.
And so what would that look like for Missouri farmers?
Well, we're a diversified state.
Fair enough.
I mean, we're livestock, grain, all of us put together. It's not just one, you know, we're complicated. So, I mean, you'd have to take a look and hear, weigh in on everybody on what they would like it to look like, say, 4 years down the road to handle a situation like this.
But, I mean, as a corn farmer or a row farmer, what exactly would you like to see in there? I mean, are there specifics that you hope they would add at some point?
Well,
or keep,
of course,
I suppose.
The insurance thing is probably most important for the row crop. One of the things probably would help is if there was a reserve, a government type of reserve program to help offset drastic events like this to help the livestock industry. And that would help them, I think.
Lonnie, you think that would be a good thing to help livestock farmers?
Well, I do. And I think, you know, looking down the road, I made this comment to one of our representatives here recently. You know, as far as the farm bill goes, you know, there needs to be some kind of provision in there for younger producers to take the land and livestock that some of these older producers are going to be leaving behind as a point of retirement, that type of thing, to help these young guys get started and to help them along, because it's a tough old road when you've got to purchase all of your land or rent all of your land and purchase all the cattle and pay the interest and principal payments that need to be made along the way and make a living. And, you know, there's a good number of livestock farmers out there that they're either doing it along with row cropping, or they're doing it as part-time with a part-time job or a full-time job. And you've got a lot of livestock producers out there now with the average age of being in the upper 50s, you know, probably don't owe a lot on their operations, and they can get by. But these young folks, I think there needs to be a program of some sort in there to help them get started and help them to take over what we're going to leave behind one of these days.
Right. And what's a typical percentage that a farmer would pay of his income toward debt service?
Probably Raymond might know that. I'm not sure.
Well, actually, it's been reducing. Right now, the amount of income farmers are paying on debt service, and this would be crop, livestock across the whole U.S., would be about 30% of their income. That is significantly down from what it was in the 80s, where it'd be over 50%, not like in 60 and 70%. So right now, farmers are sitting fairly well financially, and that's one reason that this is not quite as bad as like in the 30s, where farmers are just saying, hey, I'm about to go under, is their debt is pretty low right now.
Okay. We're going to have to end there. Thanks to our guests today, Steve Wright, Vice President of the Missouri Farmers Union, Patrick Ganan, Extension Assistant Professor of Climatology at the University of Missouri, Raymond Massey, Extension Professor of Agriculture and Applied Economics at MU, and on the phone we had Lonnie Duckworth, President of the Missouri Cattlemen's Association. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or by going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of the program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar. Our technical director is Travis McMillan. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.